and good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. This is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair for our weekly meeting. And we have such a special program today. I would almost say that there is a yellow puddle underneath my chair. But I'm not going to say that. And in particular, it is a special program because there are three people that are special in my life and are going to have their opportunity to say without any restriction whatever it is that they want to say about your Captain Joe. On the greetings today especially go out to all of Captain Joe's people, their children, their grandchildren, even maybe their great-grandchildren, who are graduating from some institution of higher learning. I've been getting signals all week about graduations from high school and from university, especially about grandchildren who have worked hard and who have been admitted to their degrees or have graduated high school. And so it is a special pleasure and privilege for me as your captain to extend my personal greetings. And in particular, I always send greetings from Singapore on one side of the world to the Kingdom of Sweden on the other, of which Stockholm is the capital, and Selma, who is one of my Stockholm family, is graduating from high school, which is a really big, big deal in Sweden. It's such a big deal that my Stockholm family is having a big reception in her honor. So, Selma, congratulations and well done from your captain. On the binnacle list today, I send out special remarks and reminders that all of you who are on the binnacle list, I've got the counselor with me today, and he's been on the binnacle list for a couple of weeks. Captain O'Brien, who is slowly working himself into the upright position, and all of the rest of Captain Joe's people who either have been or remain on the binnacle list, you remain in the palm of my hand. And so this is also going to be a quick you-know-who-you-are entry. I am the repository of many, many secrets. And those repositories are in the compartments. I live in a compartmented life. And each one of my people who comes to me is a member in a compartment that we share, and they are confident that whatever they tell me remains inside that compartment. And that is particularly true of people who have medical conditions that they are not ready to share with anyone other than a small group of people for whatever reasons they may have. And I honor and respect that. And I want every one of Captain Joe's people who do share with me those confidences to know that they are safe and secure. So this is a new you know who you are in a number of cases of in medical conditions, that you remain in the palm of my hand. It is my hope, my wish, my desire, and your command that you follow the instructions of your medical practitioner. And having now gotten to that, we're going to go around. My first friend, you all know that I never have guests here. I only have friends. And my first friend is Josh Humphreys, who was a shipmate of mine in the Coast Guard cutter Ingham in Vietnam. And sitting next to him is Captain Truman O'Brien, who is an Army veteran. And by the way, tomorrow is the Army's birthday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a
248.
48. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, there you go.
So tomorrow we are going to have elephants, giraffes, and other parade right down the middle of Vashon Highway Southwest.
I'm sure.
To honor your 248th birthday.
Good.
And next to him is the counselor, Craig Bellis. And Craig did not serve in the military, but his service on the island far transcends that of many, many people here on the island. And I am going to bring him in because we're going to do a little bit of service education here. And I also have a couple of questions for him about the relationship of young attorneys and their older, I don't like to use the word mentor, but their older teachers. So I know all three of you are online, and Josh, I'm going to start with you because the one of the things that both Counselor and Truman don't know is that you are a direct descendant of Joshua Humphrey. So give greetings to the world and tell us a little bit about that, and tell us in a short period of time, because we have to move along in a smart and seamanlike fashion to get everybody everything in that we want to cover today.
Well, thank you for having me from Eastern North Carolina. It's a pleasure to be here. In 1797, the Congress of the United States appropriated some money, and George Washington was given this money on the condition that he find a shipbuilder and go ahead and build 5, 6, 7, 10 frigates. And so George called Joshua Humphreys, who was a naval architect and a shipbuilder just outside of Philadelphia. And George sent his man over there to ask Josh to come to the office, and Josh did. And George said, well, the deal here is Congress has given us all this money, and I want you to build us a little navy. And Josh said, well, how much money are you talking about, and how many ships do you want? And George said, well, it looked to me like maybe 10 ships, and here's how much money we got. And Josh started laughing, you know, and he thought, well, George, this is not going to work. I can't build 10 ships out of this little pile of money here. He said, I can do 5 or 6 maybe. So he started and he built USS Constitution, and then the Constellation, and then the American, I think, the Chesapeake, and the United States, and there was one other which I forget. And, of course, Constitution became Old Ironsides. Yeah, yeah, so that was it. That's the way that works.
Interesting.
All right.
So, and it's still in Baltimore, right? Is that where it is?
Constellation is in Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
Constitution is still under commission at Boston Harbor.
Oh, okay.
Charlestown Harbor. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we're going to move into the subject that I know that Josh wants to talk about. So I'm going to set the stage for that. In 1968, I was the executive officer of the Coast Guard cutter Ingham. We've talked about Ingham many times on this program because I then became her captain after that. And Josh was a radarman in that ship and on that deployment. And what we have never talked about on this broadcast is the relationship between or among the commanding officer, who is all the way at the top of the ship, both physically and in the organizational structure, and his executive officer, his second command, which is what I was, and the hands that actually get the work done, of which Josh was one. And so Josh has asked me if he could characterize the relationship that we had in that particular ship. And I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know how he's going to characterize it. And my commitment and my promise to him and to all of Captain Joe's people all over the world is whatever comes out, I do at least because it's my program. And because I'm sitting up in the captain's chair, I get to defend myself if defense is necessary.
Well, and you have your finger on the big red switch.
And that's the other. That's the other thing is that I've figured out which one of these mics is Josh's.
Exactly.
And then I want. I'm going to do it this way. I want Counselor to comment on that from someone who did not grow up in that particular profession, which I did. I grew up in it. I was 17 when I started. And then over to you, Captain O'Brien, for a short but pithy talk about your relationship with your officers in Vietnam in particular.
Okay.
So, so Ray Darman, it's over to you.
Thank you. First of all, let me get this straight here about this Captain Joe.
Yes.
When you and I served together in Ingham, you were executive officer.
Correct.
So I'm going to refer to you in my little story here as executive officer.
Fair enough.
Of the ship. Okay.
Fair enough.
We had just completed 3 weeks on the gun line, firing shells and working the gun line for Vietnam. And we had finished our 3 weeks, and we were ordered back to the U.S. Naval Base in the Philippines called Subic Bay. And Subic was where we refueled and got things fixed, and most of the crew got a chance to go ashore. And the first day into Subic Bay, the executive officer called all hands to the fantail of the ship, and he announced that at the Navy base in Subic Bay, they offer something called Cinderella Liberty, which means that Liberty expired at 12 midnight.
Ah.
All hands had to be back in the base by 12 midnight. And the executive officer explained to the crew of the Ingham that we were not going to acknowledge that restriction. We are going to stay out all night.
Oh.
Well, needless to say, the crew was delighted to hear this. At 4:30 in the afternoon, everybody who was not in the duty section that day hit the gangplank out through the base into the city just outside the base. The city you have heard him talk about in the past briefly was called Olongapo City. And Olongapo City amounts to 2 blocks of, what do you call them?
Christian Science reading rooms.
Yes, yeah. 2 blocks of
Christian Science reading rooms. Yes,
yes.
Along with 3 orphanages and 1 cathedral.
Yeah. I never got to the cathedral, but anyway, it was a very jovial crowd out there. Every one of the bars had bands, and the most beautiful young girls. Oh my goodness! Oh, so
I'm just looking at this list of things that we're not to talk about.
Yes. Well, so here we get through with the first night ashore, and many of us had spent the night. We had arranged for accommodations. And the next morning at 6 o'clock, we pop up at the main gate, which is locked, and we said, let us in. You know, we got to get back aboard the ship. And the SPs, the Navy SPs said, are you kidding? Get out of here. Y'all are way, way late, and we're not letting you in. But eventually, within a few minutes, they did open the gate and put us all in a paddy wagon and took us to the brig. So we stayed in the brig till about 10 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, they brought a truck around. We all got in the truck, and we went back to the ship. Well, the duty section who had remained aboard that night, we asked every single one of those individuals, what happened? How did we get out of jail? Somebody must have done something to get us home back to the Ingham. And nobody knew anything. It was a classified top secret, it seemed. But we did know that the executive officer had been summoned, I think that's the polite word.
It is, yes.
Summoned to the admiral of the base office, and that meeting lasted about 45 minutes.
Oh.
And when the executive officer returned to the ship, we still knew nothing, and we're scared to death, frankly. We didn't know what in the world was going to happen. 4:15 that afternoon, the executive officer orders all hands to the fantail, and we knew, oh, here it comes.
Oh,
here it comes. This is not going to be good. He asked us all to gather around tight, around him. He was right in the center, and as he spoke, he very slowly turned so that every single sailor could hear exactly what he was about to say. This can't be good. We've never seen anything like this before. So he takes a bit of a deep breath and he says, Liberty will commence at 4:30 this afternoon. We are not doing Cinderella Liberty. We are staying out all night. If you want to, you can come back if you want to, but we are off duty until 0700 tomorrow morning. A deathly, deathly sound. Nobody knew what to say. So I took it upon myself to say, hip, hip. And everybody jumped in with a hooray. A hip, hip, hooray. A hip, hip, hooray. And so those men adored you. They adored you, and they would follow you anywhere after that. Good work.
All right. So, counselor has just pointed to this little sign here that says the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the board, staff, underwriters, and donors of Voice of Vashon. So, all right, Captain O'Brien, you were also enlisted hand.
I was.
And were subject to the orders and discipline of your officers.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your experience. Well, our time is really running fast. So.
All right, so I'm going to make it quick. I will say, I have two things to say. One, as an enlisted man, I was very experienced. I mean, I had been in Vietnam, and by the time I got to Europe, where I was stationed for 18 months. So I had a pretty good reputation by the time I got there. I was an E5. And so consequently, the officers recognized that experience, and they were very, very nice to me and very cordial. And so I got along great with my officers. Even in Vietnam, I did, but mainly in Europe. That was a great relationship. The one thing I wanted to talk about, though, is I was also an airline captain. And I wanted to talk about the relationship between in the crew of an airline.
Yeah, I'd like that.
It's quite different. For one thing, we had a program called Crew Resource Management, and it was a class that we went through. And let me back up. The captain of an airplane is very much like the captain of a ship, at least in the old days. They were absolutely in charge of everything, made all the decisions. There were no decisions that were made by anyone but the captain. In later years, we became much more of a crew where we depended on our first officers and engineers when we had them. So it was a little bit of different take. But I will tell you this one quick story. We had an old crusty captain. This is when I was an engineer. And he was complaining about this CRM, this class. He said, you know, if a guy's a jerk, he's going to be a jerk. 2 days of classroom is not going to change that in a guy whatsoever. And he was up on the seat, you know, on his soapbox going on about it. And when he got all through, here I am, a young engineer. I said, Captain, you know, that's correct. But if that CRM class doesn't do anything more than letting that engineer have the courage to tap the captain on the shoulder and say, Captain, you're making an error here. He said, then it's worth everything that we pay for it. Yep. And the captain sat there for a minute, and to his credit, he said, you know what? You're right. I'm going to change my opinion. By golly, that CRM, we got to do that CRM stuff. But so I speak very highly of that particular captain. He and I flew a lot together after that.
So, counselor, although we are talking about a way of life that is in some ways different, I think that there are some similarities in your way of life and the way that you were trained and the way that you were educated. And I'd like you to characterize some of that in the context of what we've been talking about here.
Well, first of all, I do want to thank all three of you for your service. I was in the first draft lottery and pulled the number 346 out of 365, of course, 366, and immediately went 1A and had 1 year of eligibility and wasn't called up. I don't really apologize for that, but that's...
There are no apologies expected or needed. No, sure.
But I have to tell you...
Not in this group.
When you talk about a military background, I went to a physical therapist. You're going to wonder how this works, how this fits together. A physical therapist here on the island years ago because my shoulders were killing me, like I had pulled, you know, ripped rotator cuffs. And the first thing the physical therapist said to me, he says, was your father in the military? And I go, yeah. And she goes, yeah, because you've been standing up too straight with your shoulders back too far. You need to relax that a little bit and whatnot. My father was actually in the European theater a couple days after D-Day and in the Japanese theater and got Purple Hearts in both. So I did have some experience with eating square meals on the edge of my seat, and that sort of thing. The practice of law has evolved. It's not quite as structured as it used to be, but there's still plenty of the kind of structure you're talking about. When I was at the Attorney General's office, we had the Attorney General, we had Deputy Attorney Generals, et cetera, et cetera. But for the most part, the Assistant Attorney Generals had total autonomy. We rarely had anybody breathing down our throat. I started out in the Education Division representing most of the universities and colleges in the state of Washington, all by myself, right out of law school. And I would just turn to these individuals for guidance and some the experience, you know, that they had. But in a traditional law firm, and I've worked in traditional law firms, we had an expression. You used to have the people who were the finders, then the binders, and then the foot soldiers. The finders, of course, were the partners who had all the connections. The binders were the ones who would smooge and do that sort of thing. And the foot soldiers were the ones who were writing all the briefs and doing all the research and that sort of thing. So in that regard, but the personality of a law firm would differ dramatically with who was at the top. Some law firms were loved by young attorneys. And others were despised just because you might have somebody who was considerate and understood and remembered when they started out, or you'd have some arrogant SOB. I think I can say SOB.
Yes, right.
That's as long
not
as
on
I
the
use
list.
The initials, that's right. That changed the whole flavor of it and were real authoritative, really didn't care about, you know, what your life was like. So
Josh and I are shipmates. And a shipmate is he who puts his mates and his ship before himself. And I have made no secret of my affection and regard and respect for Captain O'Brien and for the counselor. I use the term counselor because that to me is one of the expressions of respect for not only your profession, but also for you personally and for Captain O'Brien, with whom you and I have done many things mm-hmm. together. But I'm going to ask Josh here to characterize in the life that he and I shared how shipmates work together. And I'm just looking quickly there. We have a couple
about
minutes.
6 minutes.
So I want you to talk about that a little bit. And I'd like you to talk about that from the guy who actually was on the mess decks and in the berth decks and not back in wardroom country and not up in cabin country, but from the enlisted hand's point of view.
We did a lot of firing of projectiles ashore against the Viet Cong. And if we would fire 300 or 400 shells in an evening, in a nighttime, those shells had to be replaced. So they would be unwrapped and dropped on the tailgate, on the fantail of the ship, in pallets, and those pallets would be broken open, and the entire ship's company would be lined up to carry these 38-pound projectiles.
Yep.
You'd pick one up and hand it to the next guy and the next guy and the next guy all the way forward.
The projectiles and the powder were two separate.
Right.
Yep. That's right. But the projectile actually had an explosive in it,
mm-hmm.
and it had a beautiful, long, narrow point, just like the pictures. It was really cool. So you'd pick one from the guy to your right, hand it to the guy to the left, from the right to the left, do this for about 45 minutes, and I was 6 feet and 130 pounds back then. And, you know, it's summertime, you're sweating profusely. Guy hands me a projectile, and it begins, as soon as he handed it to me, it starts to slip. Uh-huh. And it's going down and down, and I'm wrapped around this thing like you would a telephone pole, but gravity is killing us here, and this projectile is going to hit the deck. And down it went, and I went with it, wrapped around this projectile, and it hit the deck.
Oh, man.
You could have heard a bee buzz yeah. at 1,000 yards, not a sound. XO is on the wing of the bridge, looking down upon us, and he yelled, "Humphreys," and everybody knew, well, he won't them. And then in a very kind voice, he said, "I have every intention of getting this ship replenished, and I appreciate your help, but I appreciate even more if you would do this job without blowing the ship up. Well, because of that response from the executive officer, I love this man. I will follow him anywhere we can. You call me, and we're going to see, okay?
Yeah.
Even though you're old.
Yeah. I'm not old.
None of us are old, are
no,
we?
Yeah. No. But the legs are not as good as they used to be. That part of it is
the
short.
Sea legs.
Short
you'd have trouble getting the sea legs
yeah.
going. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so counselor talking about his dad with two Purple Hearts, and we have just passed D-Day. And I have talked before, and I did last week, about D-Day and about the Coast Guard's part in D-Day. Captain O'Brien is giving me the 2 minutes there. So it is for the four of us together, you being a service brat, that's the term, by the way, of mm-hmm. what you are. You may be counselor to me. You may be a much-loved friend and much-admired person, but you know, you're still a service brat. Yep. And Truman, you're not a service brat. I know that. No, you're a veteran of a ranch and a horse vet.
Indeed.
And Josh and I are true shipmates, all of the things. So I have to now, in the minute plus a few seconds that I have left, I get to say my side of all of it. And my side of all of it was with this Ingham crew, that the guy that I relieved as the executive officer was not a sailor. He had come from a different part of the Coast Guard, and he had been sent to the ship apparently to get some sort of qualification for further promotion. And when I relieved him, I had come from a background of already having had two commands at sea myself. And so I was no cherry, I was no virgin when it came to this whole thing. And so he said, watch out for this crew because they will screw you over every chance they get. And I found that to be so completely untrue. That was a wonderful, wonderful crew, and they were worth every bit of attention that I was able to give them. And I fortunately served a captain who gave me full latitude, and I have less than a minute here to tell you that this is your Captain Joe, that we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again, and this is your Captain Joe, thanking all of my friends who have been with me today. With all of the great stories and all the memories and all of the thoughts for the future, that I remain, as always, on station and watching properly.